Hello and welcome to Still Any Good, the podcast where we run the risk of ruining our childhoods by revisiting fondly remembered films. My name's Robert Johnson, and tonight I'm joined by a failed writer who's also a useless shagging bastard. Yes, it's Chris Webb.
How dare you? Less of the shagging. How's it going?
I'm good, how are you?
I'm all right, thank you. I'm very hot. I'm in a very hot room. It's been a very, very warm day, so I'm a little bit sweaty, but it's nice. I'm just cooling myself down with a nice glass of white wine, so it's not too bad.
You haven't just been in a cultist's orgy, have you, by any chance?
Well, possibly. You're looking at the masks behind me, aren't you?
There are some masks behind you, which are very eyes wide shut, which, you know, cooling yourself off, a bit sweaty.
Yes.
I'm just putting two and two together.
You know, you're right. I have been.
How have you been?
I'm all right, thanks. Yeah, how about you?
Yeah, good. Slightly less sweaty.
I can see that.
You've Thank
kept you. Your trousers wide shut, obviously. Should we just crack on with it and just say what we've chosen?
Tonight, of course, it was your choice, wasn't it? We had a bit of a, we were supposed to do this, I think, late last year?
God, in November, something like that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And for various reasons, we delayed it. And we had, of course, our special guests on the Harry and the Hendersons pod.
That was good. I enjoyed that very much.
That was very good. And so we finally got to do this. So what is it, Chris?
Well, tonight we will be talking about the 1998 high-concept romantic comedy, Sliding Doors.
Have you ever wondered what might have been? Would things be different if you caught the train instead of missing it? How much would your life change if you were 10 minutes early?
No!
Instead of 10 minutes late.
Helen?
If I had just caught that train, I'd have been home ages ago.
You don't want to go wondering about things like that.
Now, Helen's life is about to go down two different tracks. Gwyneth Paltrow and Gwyneth Paltrow in the story of a woman about to choose between a life with the man she's always loved.
Jerry, I asked a simple question. There's no need to become Woody Allen.
And a life with the man she's just met.
I kissed you.
Yeah, I spotted that too.
Miramax Films and Paramount Pictures present a romantic comedy about one woman.
I'm over him.
No, you're not.
I am.
And life's infinite possibilities.
Don't think that
I didn't think that.
I'm truly, truly sorry.
Two lives. Two chances, and a destiny that lies behind two sliding doors.
Ooh, sliding doors,
but
Gwyneth.
It's of Gwyneth, and I know we honestly did plan to do this in November. It's not because of recent social media. We thought we'd
better
rush through a Gwyneth. I said to you earlier this week, I've had to hastily rewrite some of my notes in light of recent events.
Well, it's actually, the movie's ultra topical as well, because we've had a bit of a tragedy today.
Yes.
You know, the loss of a famous python.
Yes, that's right. Today we learned that Terry Jones had very, very sadly passed away.
Mm.
And that hit me quite hard.
Yeah, well, he's an absolute icon.
So, yeah, but you're right, that does very, very loosely tie in with some of the events of Sliding Doors, which we'll no doubt talk about in due course.
1998, that was an absolute banner year for Gwyneth, wasn't it?
It was. I think she did this sort of in between that Perfect Murder, that Hitchcock remake, and sort of that Great Expectations kind of time, and then straight away she went off and did Shakespeare in Love after those, I think.
Well, according to Wikipedia, this came out sort of January 98.
Mm-hmm.
Great Expectations, yeah. There was Hush, which I've never seen.
No.
Perfect Murder, which was, you know, it was pretty average, but did quite a good box office.
Yep.
Then, yeah, of course, culminating in Shakespeare in Love, for which she won the Oscar.
That's right.
Yeah, it was peak Paltrow, really, wasn't it? Shakespeare
it
in Love.
She never really was.
Hit those heights again.
No, she was everywhere.
And, you know, one of her three English accent movies.
Yeah, her accent, it's okay in this.
Yeah.
It's not bad. It's a bit plummy and a bit nasal, so it's very, oh, I won't grow a penis. She's doing that quite a lot. But she does a very good job of dropping consonants.
Yeah.
If you watch other American actresses, like Renée Zellweger doing Bridget Jones, it's always very tight and very much like this, yes, yes. But she's calling people a twat in this and stuff like that.
Yeah.
She's obviously done her homework, and I was mildly impressed with her accent.
I mean, it's passable. It's good. Mm. She's convincing.
Yeah, you wouldn't think, oh, it's an American doing an English accent. It's okay, it's acceptable. It's only because you know she's American that we're kind of scrutinising it, otherwise it wouldn't really matter.
But yeah, of course, worth saying that Gwyneth is pretty topical at the moment. She's sort of doing less acting these days and more vagina-scented candle making.
Yeah, essentially vagina-scented candle making.
Yeah, because she's sort of a business mogul with Goop.
With Goop, which, it's a horrible name.
It is a horrible name. And have you seen the poster, the advertisement that they have for Goop? Where she's...
Is that the one that looks like she's lying in a gigantic vagina?
Yeah, she's standing in basically the centre of a gigantic vagina.
Mm.
It's too evocative not to be deliberate.
Yeah. It's not the first time she's been in a box either.
It was the whole body this time, not just the head.
There was room this time, yeah.
Yeah, it's almost like she's embracing the whole gynecological aspect of the business. Didn't they last year recommend some stones or something to insert vaginally?
I think so. And there's been some steaming going on as well.
Yeah, and some medical professionals came out and said, no, we just want to make it clear, we do not recommend putting these pebbles in there.
No, absolutely not. And the steaming, it just causes a queue at the dry cleaners, doesn't it? I wouldn't want to do my shirts on there afterwards.
But you've got to admire a woman who sells a candle that smells like her. I suppose you do. You had a good pun. Candle in the minge.
Candle in the minge.
I tried to make a sliding doors pun out of it. It was just a bit yuck. But
so anyway, Sliding Doors.
Yes.
The film. I chose this, first of all, because I'd seen it. I saw it when it came out with my ex, and we both really, really enjoyed it at the time. We liked the fact that it was a kind of an original idea, a sort of a what if, and one moment can change your life. It was interesting because I think around about that time, there were three slightly similar rom-coms that came out, all around about the same year, and they were all based in London, and they were very, very high concept. There was this, there was one, depending on where you live, but in the UK it was called Martha Meet Daniel, Frank and Lawrence, which had Monica Potter and Joseph Fiennes in it. And the huge contrivance of that is Joseph Fiennes, Rufus Sewell and Tom Hollander are best mates and they've gone back for years. And she's an American visiting London and completely separately of one another. They all meet her and they all fall in love with her. And she's kind of trying to choose which is the best one. So it all relies very, very heavily on coincidence. And there's another
good
one.
Cast.
Which, it's a good film from what I remember. And there was another one which came out, which I remember really, really enjoying. And I would have suggested it for this, but I don't know how many people have known of it. There was a film called This Year's Love.
Ooh, it rings a bell.
Yeah, before you ask, David Gray is in it.
Yeah, yeah. But I think that's what rings a bell, the David Gray.
Once more, it's set in London, and it revolves around three couples who get together, and then they split up, and then it goes 1 year on, and by pure coincidence, they kind of end up with each other. So it sort of rotates around. But it's kind of interesting because the leads in it are people like Kathy Burke and Ian Hart and Douglas Henshaw and people like that.
So normal-looking people.
Normal-looking people, a good script and a brilliant soundtrack. So at some point, I wouldn't mind going back and having a look at that. But like I said, I don't know how many people would remember it, so I don't know if it would be an obscure one for us, like The Mutations or something.
Probably would be on a more obscure end, but as the person who chose The Mutations, I haven't got a leg to stand on to.
Neither did they. So out of those three, I thought this was kind of the more commercial and the more well-known.
Because this did pretty good box office, didn't it? I mean, it was very low budget, and it did $7 million budget and did sort of $61 million or something office, or 68 even. So.
It managed to break overseas slightly, which is sort of unusual. I suppose having a Hollywood A-lister didn't hurt.
Yeah, I mean, the whole concept of this sort of sliding doors moment has absolutely entered the collective consciousness, hasn't it?
Well, it has.
The vernacular. I mean, everyone knows what that means when you say you had a sliding doors moment.
Yes.
I think different TV shows have sort of had their sliding doors episodes. There's an episode of Frasier called Sliding Frasiers.
There is, yeah. I watched that one recently, yeah.
It sounds like a porn parody that I'd never want to watch. Yeah, so I mean, it's left its certainly left its mark. But do you think there was that those other comedies that you mentioned that were sort of London set comedies, romantic comedies? Do you think there was a bit of a let's see if we can do a Richard Curtis knockoff kind of thing going on at the time? Or
probably, but I think what made not necessarily maybe this one, but the other two a bit more interesting is because they weren't like Richard Curtis knockoffs. They weren't. Yeah. Posh people in big posh houses, you know. This year's Love is set in Camden, so there's you know, it's kind of grubby houses and flat sharing, and the Martha meet ... Although Joseph Fiennes is very posh and Rufus Sewell is very posh, they are quite slummy. And again, he lives in a council flat, and you know, Ray Winstone's his neighbour and all this sort of stuff. So it's not the kind of it's kind of posh people. It's not posh people living in a mansion going, ooey gads, and all this sort of stuff. It's it tries to be a bit more grander. It's not based on red double-decker buses driving around and stuff.
Yeah.
So I think they're a bit more interested in that regard as well. But this one...
directed by a chap named Peter Howitt.
Yeah, Joey Boswell from Bread.
Oh, God, was it?
Yeah. You didn't know that?
Because I saw that he was an actor as well, and I was kind of... I didn't really go through his filmography as an actor. I just kind of looked at what he'd done as a director and a writer and saw that he directed Johnny English, and I kind of thought, well,
there we go.
This is probably as good as it gets for
him. He did that rom-com with Pierce Brosnan and Julianne Moore as well, didn't he? Of Attraction, which is okay.
I was looking at the poster going, I mean, there's Pierce Brosnan, there's Julianne Moore, Rules of Attraction. I feel like I've heard of this, but I at the same time have absolutely no recollection of... It feels like the sort of thing I would have seen, but...
It's all right. It's all right. It's the usual, he's a lawyer, she's a lawyer. But it's not so bad, because they've got really good chemistry in it.
Oh, that's cool. Mm. Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. God, I wish I'd gone back and realised it was Joey Boswell from Bread.
Yeah. Yeah, he was in Bread for years.
I did read a little anecdote that he shared in some article about how he came up for the concept of Sliding Doors. I'm not sure if you saw that.
No, please continue.
So he was apparently crossing Charing Cross Road one day to phone a friend about a play they were doing. He saw a phone box across the road, and then he said, I think he called it a cerebral coin flip moment or something. And he just suddenly thought, I have to phone him now. I'm going to go and cross the road and use that phone booth now. He set foot out onto the street without looking and very nearly got hit by a car. Screeched to a halt sort of 1 inch from him, and that was the moment that he thought, shit, what if? What if I was Gwyneth Paltrow doing this?
Yeah, because that's something that does intrigue me is, yeah, that's great, you know, he nearly gets squashed by a car. So why choose these particular incidents as your sliding door moment?
I know.
Because it's not especially...
Cinematic
or earth-shattering or groundbreaking or anything. And it does have sort of mixed messages along the way as well, which...
There's a morality in it at the end that I don't really want to delve too deep into.
Yes.
Yeah, I thought that too, because it's a very intriguing concept, the whole alternate timelines thing.
Yeah.
But I was watching this going, oh, God, you know, Christopher Nolan or someone a bit mind-bendy... thrillery, you know, could have done
well, yeah,
you know, something really
well, really... or even Ashton Kutcher,
but a butterfly effect, kind of thing.
It's basically the butterfly effect without Ashton Kutcher's stumps, isn't it, really?
Yeah. Without him strangling himself in utero with his umbilical cord.
One of my favorite endings. Anyway,
that's what I was thinking. I was like, it's almost like a plot of an episode of Friends.
Yeah.
So perhaps he was just going for, you know, being relatable, rom-coms, it was sort of the height of the rom-com, wasn't
it? Yeah, so maybe you're right, it is that Richard Curtis overspill,
But I was watching this going, perhaps a more ambitious filmmaker with perhaps a bit more of a budget to work with could have done something a bit different, but hey.
So we talked about Gwyneth Paltrow in it. Some of the other stellar cast is we have John Lynch as Jerry.
I'm trying to remember what I know him from. He just had one of those faces, and he's got a very extensive
He's in The Name of the Father. He plays Daniel Day-Lewis, his mate in that. He played George Best.
Oh, yeah.
And if you've watched recently, it's not called The Fall, is it? The one with Gillian Anderson in it. Set in Belfast.
With Christian Grey?
Yeah, he plays the police chief in that. He's the big miserable beardy man. That's him. Yeah. So he's still working very hard. He plays miserable beardy Irishman these days. who have got a bit of a crooked past.
God, he's an absolute twat in this, isn't
he? Yeah, a total bell end.
And it was one of the things I struggled with in the film, actually, was he's one of these classic film characters who's the boyfriend who has very, very few redeeming qualities at all.
But they try to play him as charming, and he's funny, and he's a bit clumsy. Something that Hugh Grant could have done very, very easily, but John Lynch just can't do it. He hasn't got not the talent, but he's just not up to it.
The charisma.
He hasn't got the charisma, absolutely.
He's got nothing behind him, has he? He hasn't released it. He's just a total loser bum who's leeching off his girlfriend, played by Gwyneth Paltrow. Her name's Helen Quilly.
I didn't know the surname, thank you for that.
Who is in PR, and he's just a tosser. It's a real struggle as to why she's so devoted to him.
I'd struggle with that. Speaking of tosses, I've got no idea why she'd be devoted to him. It also stars John Hannah as James, who makes John Lynch just like Ryan Gosling.
When John Hannah first comes on the scene in this movie, and I was looking at him going, oh my God, he sort of looks like someone who can draw but doesn't, you know, hasn't really sort of developed their their talents. And so the forehead's a little bit out of proportion with the chin. The eyebrows are a bit too big. The shoulder pads.
It's like he's in a hall of mirrors.
He actually grew on me in this movie, because when he first came on, I was like, God, I cannot watch an hour and a half of John Hannah prattling on. Towards the end of the movie, I was kind of like, he's all right.
But he says something right at the end of the film, and I thought, you absolute wanker.
But I
just thought, I hated him so much in this film. I like John Hannah. He's a good actor. He's good in other things. John Hannah apparently said in an interview that playing James was the hardest role he's ever done. I can understand that, because he is the most insufferable dick that I think I've possibly seen in any film.
It's strange, isn't it? Because I'd actually forgotten how beautiful Gwyneth Paltrow was when she was... I mean, she's absolutely stunning in this movie, and a nice enough person.
Oh, she's fine. She's very nice.
Yeah, and yet she's shacked up with this total philandering loser, and then falls in love with a kind of a creepy, annoying, obnoxious, deceitful guy too. And loses her job in the most weakly, non-comedic, weird
rubbish
way of... It's absolutely shit.
Yeah. So obviously what happens is, at the start of the film, because we're getting to that stage now where we talk about the film, she's rushing for the tube, she's going to work, because she works in PR in the city.
Yeah. But it's never explained as to why she's such a good PR person. She never really...
No.
...evokes PR person. She doesn't use her PR skills in any way.
No.
Yeah.
She turns up late for this meeting and goes, oh, hello, I'm sorry. And then quite interestingly, in the meeting was Kevin McNally, who pops up and things, and also Nigel the Torch from Top Secret was there as well. But they've got her bang to rights. She stole some vodka from work.
She stole four bottles of Smirnoff.
Yeah, her excuse was, it's my birthday. And I thought, well, imagine the candles on that cake.
But whiffy,
clear the room out. So they fire her, which is absolutely fine, but she tries to take this moral high ground, accusing them of misogyny. She's been nicking from work, and they caught her.
It just didn't feel in any way like it wasn't funny. It didn't feel... It was weird, like someone steals four bottles of vodka and so basically is just summarily dismissed. Like, it could have been a funny, if you imagine like a Bridget Jones kind of type movie.
Absolutely.
A funny thing where she just makes an absolute tit of herself, doing something. And I get that they're not trying to, waste too much time with the setup, but it just gets the movie off to such an odd start. And she's just basically like, you've been trying to get rid of me for ages. Oh, well. And walks off.
Why have they been trying to get rid of her for ages? There's no sign that she's actually any good at her job, or that she's a threat, or that she undermines them, or anything. We only know because she said it.
Yeah, and maybe, they could have brought up office chairs have been going missing, perhaps the fax machine went missing.
A few supervisors have been found dead.
It's just so weird. She's set for stealing four bottles of Smirnoff. Obviously, it was a good product placement opportunity as well. But...
That's right, yeah.
But the height of arrogance, it's my birthday, they won't miss these four bottles of Smirnoff.
Yeah. And then she meets John Hannah in the lift.
Mm.
She drops an earring and he very gallantly picks it up for her. It's never really established why he's in that building.
No, because what does he do for a job?
Don't know.
They sort of bring it up later, I think. He's got a secretary.
No, he just does business in the city. That's all you really need to know. So that's it. Yeah, something in the city.
He's a male prostitute, isn't he?
Yes. there would be a call for that.
Yeah, yeah, for Monty Python fans.
Yeah.
Called the Spanish Inquisitor.
So Helen, she's been fired, so she's trying to get the next tube. There's a bit of a tussle with the child on the stairs with the dolls, so the child gets in the way and she misses the train.
Notice the little sound effect when she has her little moments of magic realism? It's almost like a Bewitched kind of...
I wrote ruddy, mysterious music. Because it is. And then the film rewinds, like an art house film. They rewind the film a little bit.
Yeah.
And so an alternate reality where the child doesn't get in her way and she manages to catch the train.
The child doesn't get in her way in the alternate reality because the mum violently yanks the child.
She dislocates the child's shoulder.
that's the scene we don't see. The child is dead.
But this shoulder dislocation has kind of caused a rip in the space-time continuum, which I assume is what happens. And so from then on, we get two realities. So the film is split in two, which is kind of hard to keep track of. But as luck would have it, she has a cinematically convenient haircut.
Some handy visual cues.
So my notes from now on, they're either labelled long-haired reality or short-haired reality.
Yeah.
Just so I know which one we're talking about. So forgive me if I refer to LHR or SHR as we go along, because that's why I've got them in my notes.
For me, that's my 20s versus my 30s. Long-haired reality, short-haired reality.
Oh, me too. On my 20s and onwards, yeah. But in the long-haired reality, where, of course, she's missed the train, and then there's an announcement saying all trains have been cancelled. So she goes up to catch a taxi, and she's mugged.
Yeah.
Bangs into a tree, and ends up in the hospital, which is still preferable to what happens to her next in the short-haired reality.
It is.
Because, of course, there she catches the train and sits next to John Hannah. Now, I'm going to go out on a limb and say that this is one of the worst and most frustrating scenes ever committed to film.
Mm.
Because he displays the worst in male characteristics that you could possibly think of. First of all, there's a man sitting next to him and he's happily listening to his Walkman.
Yeah.
Just sort of grooving along, quietly mumbling to himself.
Yeah.
And then John Hannah, James, he immediately starts slagging off this guy's music. Sort of
Elastic Thrombosis, that's the name of the band.
What a shit name. That's the sort of thing that my dad would come up with. Oh, you listen to now, Elastic Thrombosis, is it? But if they were called Elastic Thrombosis, they wouldn't have lyrics that kind of go, drag me to the floor, because I can't take any more. You wouldn't call yourself Elastic Thrombosis with a name like that. But I don't think they're Beatles lyrics. James is kind of going, oh, those are Beatles lyrics. Everyone knows.
Yeah.
I don't know every Beatles song, but they don't sound like Beatles lyrics to me.
No, they don't. They don't. It's very badly written.
Yeah.
Very badly written.
So he's slagging off this poor guy's music. But he doesn't bite. He just puts his headphones back on and ignores him. Quite right, too. So, of course, then he turns his attention to Helen. Who's reading a book?
She's just trying to read a book.
She clearly doesn't want to talk. But that doesn't matter to James. He starts nudging her and starts kind of going, oh, nobody talks on the tube, do they? My first thought then was Flypaper from Tales of the Unexpected. It's that guy and that little girl on the bus.
The predator, yeah.
He's going, no one talks, you can't sing. This is exactly what's going on. And he, of course, adds to it by saying, it's all right, I'm not a psychopath. Which you would say, wouldn't you?
Well, he reminded me, because every... you know, I get the train to and from work in the mornings, and every now and again there'll be someone with pretty obvious mental health issues or learning difficulties who is quite verbose on the train, sometimes pretending to be on the phone when very clearly not, or just talking rubbish. that's what he reminded me of.
I'm okay if somebody is emotionally vulnerable and they want to talk, because there's no filter, there's no barrier. When I take the bus in the morning, there's a man with Down syndrome, William, my friend William, who catches the bus. And he's lovely. I have a nice little chat with him. He tells me all these funny stories about how he got drunk on his birthday and stuff. That's fine. But when it's supposedly people like James, if you've got headphones in or if you're reading a book, yeah, or if you're pretending to be asleep, which I used to do on the bus too, you clearly want to be left alone.
Yeah, it's no wonder, spoiler alert, his bloody wife's divorcing him, is it?
Yeah, it's not the old, oh, nobody ever talks to each other anymore. You clearly don't want to talk to somebody. It's intimidation. She's reading a book. She tells him she's reading a book. He knows she's reading it because he makes some sort of smart-ass comment about her book.
She's got stitches in her bloody eyebrow.
Not this one, she hasn't.
Oh, not this. Oh, so, oh,
that's okay, the long-haired reality. Wrong reality. You're in the long reality. The short-haired reality.
They've both got long hair at this point.
They do. But come on. Give me something. It just doesn't stop him. It's clear she doesn't want to talk. And even when she finally breaks her silence and says, look, I don't want to talk. I just want to read my book. He carries on talking about himself. He's going, oh, I've had a great day today, actually. It's brilliant. It's wonderful. And she says she's been fired. Doesn't stop him. And then he says, have we met before? I think, you fucking stalker.
Yeah, he's an absolute...
This is Andrew Lincoln territory.
Creep.
Yeah.
He's a creep. Yeah.
So at last, the train stops. She gets off. And he's obviously done his job very well because she apologises to him.
Yeah, he's negged her to the point. Yeah.
She's, I'm so sorry. Yeah, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. She should just be saying, I'm so sorry. Just fuck off.
Yeah. Thanks for gaslighting me into thinking that I'm in the wrong... for just trying to mind my own business on the train. Yeah.
It's a scene that infuriates me, and it is one of the major reasons that I just loathe James. I can't stand him.
They're just such a strange pairing as well, because, I mean, she's only, what, 26 in this. He looks...
He's about 40.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And at the time, she was, of course, in real life, famously coupled up with Brad Pitt. I was reading an article about, because he proposed to her, was madly in love with her, apparently, and she kind of got cold feet and kind of ended the relationship. But apparently there was a baseless rumour that she had been having an affair with John Hannah on the set.
It's feasible.
Of this movie.
I'm so sorry, it's feasible.
And I was watching this movie going, there is no way she was cheating on Brad Pitt with this guy.
Yeah, baseless.
No one hates themselves that much to do that.
My God, bit of rough. Yeah. But while all this is going on, Jerry, who's supposed to be at home writing his book, is having it off with his ex-girlfriend Lydia, played by Jean Triplehorn.
Yeah, so named because she'll give you the horn at least three times.
It is a perfect name. Now, if we're talking about performances and charisma or whatever, there's a definite gender split in this because Jerry and James are awful. But the performances by Gwyneth Paltrow and Jean Triplehorn are good. Jean Triplehorn especially. Endlessly watchable. She's great.
And they're both impossibly good looking. And the guys are just utter schlubs.
Yeah. We're getting into male fantasy territory really, aren't we? Of course, Helen goes home. We're still in short-haired reality. And she catches Jerry kind of mid-O.
This was gross.
Yeah.
I didn't enjoy that scene at all. I thought it was really yuck.
No. They tried to make it funny, which he's kind of going, oh, I thought you hated Elton John. Oh, I like him sometimes. Do you want a cup of tea? That'd be nice. It's not pleasant. And then she sort of attacks him and starts calling him names. And this is something that really annoys me about the script. She uses the word shagging as an adjective.
You useless shagging bastard.
Nobody uses the word shagging as an adjective.
Yeah.
They've obviously tried to tone it down from the F-bomb and thought, isn't it funny? Austin Powers might have just come out. A lot of British people say shag. And they've completely misunderstood how that word's used.
Yeah, well, Americans might call someone a fucking bastard, so obviously British people call someone a shagging bastard.
Yeah, but this is written by a British person.
He should know.
I think Sidney Pollack had a big hand in this, so he might have sort of said, oh, change it for an American market. Use a
that
word
was Pollack's
that...
touch. Yeah. We have left out that John Hannah does sign off.
Oh, how could I forget?
Yeah, it's his trademark.
Yeah,
he's a little Monty Python. You know what the Monty Python boys say?
Yeah, and she says, "Oh, look on the bright side of life." And he goes, "No, no one expects the Spanish Inquisition." So of course now there's a vacancy in the Python lineup. I think John Hannah could fill that role.
Oh, he could.
Yeah, he knows all the words. We know that.
Yeah.
And that must be like catnip to a beautiful young woman like Helen. Someone going, oh, I've quoted Monty Python.
Young, famously popular with young women, Monty Python.
Do a bit of Hancock afterwards or something, yeah. but this
is where some of the really exposition-heavy dialogue comes in as well, because she's having her argument with her philandering boyfriend, Jerry. And she says, I work all hours to support you while you're supposedly writing your first novel.
That's like character notes in the front of the script, isn't it? It really this is Helen. She's working all hours while her boyfriend supposedly writes a novel.
It's a sort of dialogue where the other person would be like, yeah, I know that. Why are you...
We all know this.
Why are you saying this to me? And then shortly after, when he turns up at her best friend's house to try and win her back or talk to her, and he says, Ella, you're Helen's best friend. Where else would she go? Again, Ella would be like, yeah, I know she's my best friend. Why do you need you to?
Yeah. Probably the first draft of the script had her picking up the phone going, hi, Helen's best friend here.
It's just, and there's a lot of dialogue like that.
Yeah, it's very clumsy. Very clumsy. Mm. But if we then do some ruddy, mysterious music and we go back to the long-haired reality where, of course, Helen has been mugged and she's in hospital. Of course, because she's in hospital, Jerry and Lydia can finish off uninterrupted, which is nice. So she comes home. Jerry is still doing his bumbling prick routine. So she tells him she's been fired and mugged. And he tells her he's going to get her alarmingly out of her head on product placement. On Grolsch, which you can't get more 90s than that.
And of course, he does the old comedy knock because there's the two glasses of brandy.
He knocks it into the laundry basket.
Knocks one of them into the laundry basket. Yeah.
But getting you alarmingly out of your head on some fizzy lager.
Yeah.
She's going to burp herself into a coma, isn't she?
It's certainly not the easy way.
Absolutely.
You'd think maybe tequila, maybe some whiskey or some vodka or something.
Yeah. It's also really hard to open the bottle. It's not going to work. Unless you have like a yard of Grolsch or something.
Yeah. Because young women famously love Grolsch just as much as they love Monty Python.
They love their Grolsch.
Bit of Grolsch, bit of Monty Python. The perfect first day.
And then we get something which it is exposition, but I actually like these little vignettes, which is Jerry in the pub with his friend Russell.
Who pisses himself laughing.
Yeah.
That work the most, yeah.
Yeah, because everybody in a rom-com has got a confidant. Helen's got one, which is Anna, Zara Turner, and Jerry has got Russell. And these bits did make me laugh out loud. Whenever Russell just burst out laughing, it just cheered me up. And I thought, oh, this is all right. These are good bits.
Because he sort of punctures Jerry's bullshit a bit and just, laughs at him and calls him out on being just a cowardly, deceitful.
Absolutely.
Philanderer, yeah.
Yeah, they're nice bits. They're very, very enjoyable.
Yeah, it's much more preferable to have Jerry talking to Russell than Jerry talking to himself in the mirror, which he does as well.
He does.
Which I found very fucking strange.
Yeah, it's because he's a big, bumbling, floppy-haired fool. But back to the short-haired reality. Helen is in the same pub, getting out of her head on Grolsch, but she's by herself. And if you thought that wasn't bad enough, James turns up. And he bothers her, of course.
Yeah.
Saying, oh, come and join us. But she's obviously very sad. But Helen's friend Anna turns up. And so they accept a lift from good old Flypaper James. So now he knows where they live.
It's all falling into place for him.
Fools. It really is falling into place. We never see his house. Presumably because there's like a shrine of cut-out photos of Gwyneth Paltrow and, I don't know, Jill Dando or somebody.
And he's probably got a van in his garage and a fake cast.
Absolutely.
And he sort of puts on...
Yeah, while I'm quoting Monty Python, just help me put this sofa in the back of the van, really.
Yeah, but put the lotion on the skin. thank God we didn't get the tucking in scene with Johanna.
Oh my word. I will knock one testicle behind, one testicle and a penis. Two things I will lock behind my leg.
I'd fuck me.
But he's not a psychopath or a stalker. And just to prove that, he turns up at their house the very next morning.
Mm.
And so he takes her out for a milkshake and acts like a knob. He's just cracking crack jokes and stuff. And this is where Helen gets her cinematically convenient haircut. So we can easily identify the realities.
It's the first of, I counted, I think, at least three, possibly four musical montages in the film.
Yeah.
There are a lot of montages. Oh, they're being kind to the viewer here by finally letting her get her hair cut.
Yeah.
Because up until this point, all we've had is the
the eyebrow.
The sticking plaster.
And that's got to come off sometime. But back with long hair, back in long haired reality, Helen's got herself some work waitressing and delivering sandwiches. And then she has the risque exchange with the sleazy man. Who is Peter Howard?
Yeah. Ah.
The guy who says, "Hey, gorgeous, what do you do when you finish here?" That's Peter Howard, the director.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. She says something smutty about what happens. She loses her job again. There's a pattern here.
Mm.
Then we get the discussion about brandy glasses. We get Chekhov's brandy glass.
Yes.
Because she asks Jerry about brandy glasses, and he goes, "Oh, it's probably your crazy friend Anna when you had your birthday party. She was probably sick in the laundry basket because she couldn't stand the smell of the candles."
I have also written here, just on the new hairstyle, yes, on the short haired reality hairstyle, I've written here that it's a what the young kids who look at memes these days would call a Karen hairstyle.
Is that right?
There's a lot of memes about white women who ask to speak to a manager named Karen who have a particular hairstyle.
Oh.
It's a Karen hairstyle.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
Yeah.
So is it meant to be like a sort of a power cut, if you like? Not that the electricity's gone.
Yeah. Then you light a vagina scene with a candle.
But then, because she's asking Jerry about the brandy glasses, he gets a bit neurotic and she says, "Oh, you know, I asked a simple question. There's no need to become Woody Allen." Well, that's aged well, hasn't it? And back in short haired reality, where of course she knows James and she's been out for milkshakes, the next thing he's with a pretty lady in a big house, so it looks like he's a bit of a bounder as well. He's a cad.
It does.
But he tries his Monty Python lines on his mum, and even she's heard them because she knows them too, so he's bandying his Monty Python about willy nilly.
She's feigning dementia just to get him to fuck off, basically.
"Just put me in a hospital. I can't stand you banging on about the Spanish Inquisition again." And neither can we, because the very next scene, he's having a dinner party with friends, which Helen comes along to, and he's amusing the whole room by quoting the Spanish Inquisition from Monty Python's Flying Circus. And they are loving it, and he's doing the funny voices, and he's a card. He's so brilliant.
So good.
God, I love him. I think, why is nobody spitting in his food? Or he's pouring broken glass in it or something. But this has inspired Helen to improve herself. She says she's worked in PR. So she gets a business loan from the NatWest very quickly.
Yeah, James just says, "Oh, you should set up your own business."
Yeah, and the next day she's got one.
Yeah, and then we're straight into another montage of her setting up her PR business.
It's a PR business. She gets the loan very, very quickly. No coincidence that the global financial crisis occurred a couple of years later. This is what caused it. but then I see she's only just started, so she's not going to have any clients. And she's already got staff.
Yeah.
That's not good cash flow. Terrible business model.
You know, as I said earlier, there's nothing about anything she does that says, "Oh my God, you're such a good PR person." You know, it's not like Jerry Maguire, where, you know, throughout the whole film, he's really selling the fact that he is an amazing agent.
She's not assertive in any way. She doesn't sell herself or anything.
She hasn't helped anyone with her amazing communication skills or...
No.
But she could have been anything. She could have been an accountant. She could have been a bloody hairdresser. Like...
Yeah.
Especially with that Karen dude.
But because she's been wowed by James, she attends a boat race that he's taking part in. He's on the Thames, and they're all cheering him along while Dodgy play in the background.
I thought this was really obnoxious as well. So there's this race going on, these two teams, and then there's Gwyneth Paltrow and James's mate just not shutting up for 1 second, just yelling at them the whole time. If I was on the other team, I'd be like, "Can you
shut your girlfriend up, please? Yeah,
this isn't fair." And then, of course, this is where the two alternate timelines kind of intersect a little bit, because we see.
Yeah, that's right. So in the long haired reality, they're in the same place, and she's kind of going, "Oh, I knew there'd be a boat race going on here today." This is where those kind of messages start to get mixed about the reality splitting, because it almost suggests that you're fated to be in the same place and you're fated to end up in the same place.
It's a bit odd. So they're going for sort of like a magic realism kind of thing, but there's no real...
No. If your message is anything can happen just by one small change, that's not what's happening here, because they're destined to be in the same place.
There's like a bit of serendipity kind of going on as well.
Or... Yeah. But after the boat race, then we get these tedious sort of public school antics in the pub, which are of course led by James. They're doing this ridiculous dance.
It's like a weird game of Simon Says or something. It's like... So unappealing.
It reminded me of when the rugby team are in And they just do, they take over the place by going, rah, da, 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 rah, 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 rah. You think just another half a lager and they're just going to be noshing each other off in the corner for a dare.
It's the sort of thing you imagine a young Boris Johnson doing.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really obnoxious. But Jerry and Lydia are outside and he sees her and he's sort of slightly taken because she's had her hair done and she's enjoying herself. Mm. And this is where Lydia is clearly she's being portrayed as the only villain of the piece, and James is just this lovable bumbler. Oh, not James, Jerry is this lovable bumbler, and that's wrong. All she wants is to have her boyfriend back. She wants them to split up so she can have him.
You can understand her motives at least. It's like, well, okay, all's fair in love and war. She loves him, she wants him back.
And he's told her all of this, and he's just stringing them both along. But she's the Cruella, and he's just this. This lovable guy who flops around the place.
So he's got the little curtains kind of hairstyle, isn't he?
Yes.
So got the little...
Yeah, it's like Sean Ryder.
Yeah, Hugh Grant pulled it off a hell of a lot better.
Absolutely. But after all of this, we get James and Helen somehow sitting on a boat in the middle of the Thames at night. The party's over, all the other rowers have gone home. And they're sort of chatting clumsily, it's not going very well. And it's only when James makes a joke about Gary Glitter that...
I've written this as well.
She loves jokes about... She's talked about Woody Allen. She loves nonsense, obviously.
This is hilarious. She's talking about how his first love, who was only 8 years old, how she left him for Gary Glitter.
Yeah, he wanted to touch her there. Why don't you just go for the trifecta and talk about Prince Andrew?
Jimmy Savile.
That would really get her going.
Jim will fix it.
Yeah, he fixed it for me, Helen. Yeah.
But I thought that was just another joke that just has not aged well.
Absolutely not. If this is going to be shown on telly, there's at least one joke that they're going to edit out and that's it. Or they'll get him voiced over with somebody else.
Have you ever seen, as an aside, it was a Gary Glitter, This Is Your Life? Have you seen the clip of Roald Dahl's daughter coming out?
No.
You'll have to find it on YouTube. Because apparently, I'm sure it's Roald Dahl's daughter. Apparently he stayed with them when he was... sort of between houses or something.
Okay.
And he was a celebrity at this time, and she is telling the story about how all her young schoolgirl friends would come over to the house and fawn over Gary Glitter. Gary, he actually at one point mouths no and sort of like does a neck. Yeah.
Oh my and God.
It's really like with hindsight.
Shit, that's terrifying.
I'll send you the link.
Oh my God.
But he's sort of doing this kind of rictus smile throughout the whole thing, like...
Don't say too much. Oh, my word.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. But it obviously works for Helen, because she makes a move on James, and they spend the night together. So it's all going well for Helen and James, which is great. But back with the long-haired Helen, Jerry and Lydia have gone away on a dirty weekend, so...
In Dorset. Two go mad in Dorset.
Yeah, which is where our previous guest, Fran Jolly, he lives in Dorset.
Oh, does he?
Yeah. Uh-huh. He lives in Poole, which is in Dorset, So, no, it's nice. Dorset's very nice. But he's told her he's on a research trip for his book that he's writing, because he keeps telling us that he's writing a book, just in case we forget. Yeah. But he's gone away on a dirty weekend with Lydia. And we just get a load of sort of subpar Brian Ricks cobblers. It's like a big bedroom farce going on. There's a lot of shit about corned beef sandwiches and knocking on the door, and it's so boring.
Yeah.
It's very tedious. So Helen's trying to tell him that she's pregnant, but he's not listening. And then while Helen's working, she overhears some argument on another table with that bloke who used to be in Game On. They're talking about flowers. If you buy flowers, it's clear that you're cheating on me or something like that.
Yeah, that's right.
And then Jerry gives her flowers. Yeah. Ergo, affair.
Is this where she has a written disturbance in the force moment between both Helens?
She does. Yes.
Yeah.
Because she's feeling a bit woozy there.
It's like when Leia, when Han gets killed and the Force Awakens, and Leia does a little, oh. It's like Helen saying, it's as though one creepy cheating boyfriend has put the wool over my eyes. Screamed out in terror.
Whereas the farce awakens in the hotel, isn't it? But,
very much so.
Yeah. But PR Helen, short-haired PR Helen, she's magically, because she's so good at PR, set up a big opening night for one of James's friends in a restaurant because he's a chef. Then Jerry turns up because, of course, he's seen her in the pub and he thinks he wants her back because she's got nice hair now. He tries to get her back and James sees it and James doesn't like it. And this is where she has her disturbance in the force. She has...
Yeah, that's right. Because Jerry kisses her, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. She has dizzy spells in parallel universes.
Yeah.
But this is also, I think, does Lydia tell Jerry that she's pregnant?
Yeah.
I think she does.
Dump him? She dump him at this point.
She's already dumped him.
She's dumped him.
She dumped him right. outside the pub. She's a perfect
That's
story,
right.
perfect ending for your book, the end.
That's right, because he goes and has a chat with Russell where he goes, I've bloody done it.
I've
gotten rid of
that's
it.
Right.
I actually thought that was quite funny.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
yeah.
But of course, Lydia's back because she's pregnant. She's told Jerry that she's pregnant in the short-haired world. And I think Helen realises that there's no future for her and Jerry. And this is where I think Anna says, oh no, I hate brandy. I don't like brandy. It wouldn't have been me. And so, of course, Helen works out that Jerry's been lying about the brandy glasses.
Mm.
It's all getting a bit pointless, to be honest.
I was really struggling by this point.
I'm just gabbling here. I really am. Oh, brandy glasses, blah, blah, blah. And this is where, in the short-haired world, after all her stumbling,
yes.
Helen realises that she's pregnant. And she knows this because she keeps a list of her periods in her Philofax.
This is something I could... Knowing what we know now about Gwyneth, this is something I could see her doing, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Maybe that's where she got the idea from.
That's next on the Goop merch.
Period
Philofax. Period
Philofax.
If we still had Philofaxes.
I'm sure she can bring them back. So she goes to see...
Scented Philofax.
So she goes to see James... at his place of work, his business in the city. But she talks to the receptionist, Sharon Exposition, who says, no, he's not here. He's gone to the hospital to visit his mother with his wife.
With his wife.
Because you would say that, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
James tries to find Helen to explain. It starts to rain, so you know there's going to be like a heartfelt confrontation. It's a rom-com.
Yeah.
If it rains, it's the end.
I feel like
you,
Peter Howlett was saying to himself, what would Richard Curtis do right now?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
He would reign. So James says that, as you said, you know, he's separated from his wife, but they're pretending, so his mum's not too unhappy. And I thought, his mum's dying. Could things actually get any worse?
His mum doesn't give a fuck.
No. She says, I don't care. Just stop banging on about Monty Python and get out of my mansion.
Yeah.
And then he says something which made me hate him even more. He said that his mum's ill, possibly dying. And so to try and win her over, he says, do you have a mum, Helen?
I know.
Awful.
What the hell?
Awful.
He's just continuing with his sort of emotionally abusive gaslighting
Absolutely.
Kind of character, isn't he?
But it worked.
It's just, yeah.
It works. She goes to him and then he says, permission to engage the enemy, sir. you Wankstein.
Yeah, he's moved on to sort of Blackadder, Hugh Laurie characterization.
Permission to shout bravo at an inconvenient moment. Yeah, absolutely. He's a horrible, awful man.
He's an
terrible.
Absolute
yep,
bastard.
His wife or soon to be ex-wife isn't staying with him to pretend to his mum. It's because he won't let her leave. I've got you tagged. If you move more than 3 miles away, I'll find you. There's no pretense. She's not allowed to leave. But it works. Helen and James are in love. It's going to be a happy ending. It's fantastic. Meanwhile, in the long-haired reality, Lydia turns out to be the person who has called Helen over for an alleged job interview. And, of course, Jerry is there. And she tells Helen that I'm pregnant. We're going to decide whether to keep our baby or not. So she's pregnant too, unless she's read Helen's file of facts and got a bit confused. So Helen runs and falls down the stairs. Meanwhile, exactly the same time, in the short-haired reality, James says he loves Helen, and then she's immediately squashed by a van. Probably for the best.
I laughed, and I don't think it was played for laughs.
It's funny.
they're just standing in the middle of the road.
Yep.
But then, you know, she's literally a possum in the headlights.
Yeah.
Just shows her looking at the headlights. Seems like an eternity.
That van had plenty of time to slow down.
He just went for it. Yeah, maybe it was God who's been, like, looking at both timelines this whole time going, fuck.
It's interesting you said how the film was inspired. This is the Peter Howlett moment, isn't
this
it?
This is the Peter Howlett moment,
He decided to build a whole film around someone getting squashed by a van.
Mm. We could have all been saved from this movie if he had, in fact, got squashed by the car.
Yeah, that's right.
What if?
In an alternate reality, me and you were talking about something completely different.
Yeah, we'd be doing the Joseph Fiennes one.
Yeah. but again, those parallels, she has lost her babies in both realities. So in the long...
Which I found a bit icky.
Yeah,
I found
this it's very distasteful.
It was kind of like, hey, blessing in disguise.
Mm, that's exactly right.
It's sort of like, oh, well, you know, hey,
every cloud. Yeah.
Yeah, you're not going to have your cheating boyfriend's baby anymore.
That's right. Woo! And Jerry tries to patch it up with her, and she tells him to sod off, which is fine. But of course, in the short-haired reality, while all this is going on, she's just dead. She dies.
Yeah.
That's it. Dead. Which is a very strange ending for a romantic comedy.
Just, I suppose, it was very, very strange. I suppose it's a sort of supposed to be a subversion of expectations, because you're sort of supposed to think, well, everything will be going great. And the,
it's very pessimistic.
You know, very pessimistic.
It's also very cynical. You think they're going to be happy, tell you what, I'll just kill her.
But it's kind of like saying you can't rely on those sort of serendipitous moments where you make a seemingly trivial choice that sets you on a different path. You actually have to actively choose to change your life, not just rely on it. Yeah.
We seal our fate with the choices we make. You know, a philosopher said that, Gloria Estefan.
And she was a wise woman. Also, the rhythm is going to get you.
Yeah, or the van. It was a Ford rhythm.
Yeah.
So she's dead. Short-haired reality, dead. In long-haired reality, she's told Jerry to bugger off. And on the way out, who's in the lift? James!
Yeah.
Well, of course, she's only met once before in the lift at work where she dropped her earring. That's the only time that they've ever crossed paths.
I bet he farts in lifts as well.
I bet he does.
And he thinks it's funny. He actually goes...
Yeah, he always says something like, well, better out than in, or something like that. He'll use one of those. But he's living up to his other reality's characteristics because...
Yeah.
She's just come out of hospital. She's pale. She looks ill. And she's unhappy.
Ticks all the boxes for him.
Yep. So the first thing he says to her is, cheer up. You give us a smile, love. It's awful. But he seals the deal with some more Monty Python bollocks.
Yeah.
But the big crossing of paths is the fact that she knows it. She doesn't know how she knows it, but she knows the joke. She knows the punchline.
So is it trying to say, like, when we have moments of deja vu or moments of uncanny kind of prescience on things, it's because we're tapping into the multiverse? And this is the other thing that doesn't hold water. There'd be more than just one alternative timeline in your life.
Well, there'd be stuff for every second of your life.
You make 1,000 choices a day, at least.
That's the whole point of the theory, isn't it?
Yeah.
Of the multiverse, yeah.
So why is it just this?
Yeah.
There's no internal logic to why we're looking at these two things, you know? Like,
I honestly don't think, and I may be wrong, maybe Peter Howitt has looked into the physics, but I don't think he's thought about it in that much detail. I think he just basically thought, oh, that would look good.
Yeah.
That would be nice.
Yeah.
And that's the end of his internal logic.
It's a
logic.
Gimmick.
Yeah.
It's it.
There was a feeling that would be satisfactory because she's dead in the short-haired reality, but she's not really, because her spirit is living on with long-haired Helen because she knows James and she knows his jokes.
It's the same genius that had him pose the great question, what if Rowan Atkinson was a spy?
Yeah. Or what if we turned a Barclaycard advert into a film? Was the real what if?
Yeah.
A lot of deep questions there. So we're obviously led to believe that it's great, it's going to be a happy ending for her, but we know it's not because she's with James.
Who's an absolute, utterly reprehensible...
He's a tool of the First Order.
He's an absolute tool of the First Order.
And then if that wasn't a cursed enough ending for Helen, we get Dido over the end credits.
Yeah. What disappointed me was that when short-haired Helen died in James's arms, that he didn't start reciting a W.H. Auden.
Yeah, exactly.
didn't have a scene at her funeral.
Well, he wouldn't be reciting W.H. Auden.
He used to love funerals.
He'd be reciting T. Jones and M. Palin, wouldn't he?
Her favourite poem was Always Look on the Bright Side of Life.
By M.P. Flying Circus. So, that's it. The credits roll up to Dido. The end.
The door has been slid shut. Chris, sliding doors, still any good?
Not especially, no. there are some bits of it which are okay. Like we said, I thought Paltrow's performance was good. I thought Gene Triplehorn was great. The little interludes with Jerry and Russell were super. It's quite unusual to sort of see that kind of relationship with the lead and their confidant. It doesn't normally go in that way. He doesn't support him in any way at all, which is great. It was very, very funny. But the rest of it, no. I mean, the two male leads are shockingly intolerable. Just unbelievable. What has she done in one of her other existences to be punished by having to choose between just the bottom of the barrel? They're terrible, terrible people. I like the idea of the film. I like the idea that, you know, even the smallest thing can change the direction of your life. But it's like we says, it kind of doesn't. It suggests fate rather than the fact that it is a split reality. And it's destined to be that way. Whichever path she chooses, she's either going to end up dead or with a total bell end. Either way, it's not a very good ending for her. She's just damned. As well as it. But incredibly smug. Very smug and tries to be very, very knowing. It tries to tick those rom-com boxes, like we said, with John Lynch being the bumbling one, with John Hannah allegedly being the charming suitor. But neither of them are likable in any way. And so you actually need to want them to get together. And with this, you just think, just get out, just go.
Mm.
So no, I didn't think it was any good. What about you?
Oh, yeah, I mean, there were bits of it which I found sort of mildly pleasantly inoffensive, kind of in a vanilla way, you know. It did sort of evoke a bit of 90s nostalgia for me, just the look of it and the...
The soundtrack did that for me.
The soundtrack, very much so.
Because there's Aqua on there, there's Dodgy, there's Blair, the boy from the Oxo adverts, singing Have Fun, Go Mad.
I was incredibly bored about 45 minutes in, and I thought, far out, there's another 50 minutes or something left to go. How? Why? How are they going to pad this out? It was very sitcom-y, you know, it was a lot of farcical sitcom scenes, and I thought Gwyneth Paltrow, I think you can really see the star quality there.
Yeah, like, yeah.
You know, and again, Gene Triplehorn, effortlessly charming and well-played. But yeah, very strange, half-baked philosophy behind it.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, the concept, like we said sort of earlier, a much more clever director and a better writer, someone actually wanted to really delve into it, could have done something quite cool with this.
Mm.
But yeah, it was just kind of pointless.
Yeah, I agree.
And I was just so bored by the end of it. The biggest laugh I got in that movie was when Shorthead, I'm just going to call her Karen, gets ploughed down by the van. It was... The only regret I had at that point was that James didn't get collected by it too.
He was behind it. We know he was.
I mean, I would have loved to have seen that. Just...
Oh, my word.
Well, have you ever watched You on Netflix?
No, I haven't, actually.
It's very good.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very good. Bingeable.
I should give it a go then, because we're always on the lookout for something new. So, what have we got next?
Well, we're coming up to, of course, Waitangi Day here in New Zealand, which is a very special public holiday for us. Mm. Of course, we didn't do one last year, did we?
We didn't. We did actually record one on Waitangi Day, because I remember Phil Collins was playing an open-air concert outside my house.
That's right.
And you could hear him in the background.
That's right. But yes, of course, now our first year, we did Once We're Warriors, of course.
Yeah.
I was having a think, okay, what's a bit of New Zealand cinema that we can look at this year, and probably a bit of an very obscure one for our international listeners, an animated film based on very, very successful comic strip called Foot Rot Flats, and the movie is called Foot Rot Flats, The Dog's Tale.
Great. I have limited knowledge of Foot Rot Flats. I know about it, I recognise the pictures, I know what the dog looks like, but I've never seen this, I've never even read the comic strip, so... be an interesting one to watch.
Well, I hope so. This could be my Digby.
I kind of hope it is, because you've never forgiven me.
So, yeah.
Let's do some housework. So, if you want to get in touch with us, we're on Twitter, @StillAnyGoodPod.
Instagram, StillAnyGoodPod.
We're also on Facebook, StillAnyGood. And if you want to email us, it's StillAnyGood@gmail.com. Thank you, Rob. I enjoyed that one tonight. That was good.
Thank you.
And I will see you very, very soon.
Talk to you all soon. Bye.
See you. Bye.
Okay. Hello and welcome. I'll just do that again because I think I was breathing heavily.